Welcome to the Tour Life Podcast from Well Better Best. I'm Janine, your host, integrative nutrition health coach and personal trainer. In the past 10 years, I've had the privilege of meeting some of the most interesting and hardworking professionals in the music industry. Whether you are a fan of live music or someone who actually puts on the shows, you'll find some great stories, advice, and encouragement to live a happier, healthier life doing what you love. Today's guest is an award-winning tour manager who has worked with artists such as The Black Keys, Lil Dicky, Major Lazer, Imagine Dragons, Lucinda Williams, The Replacements, Chase Rice, and a long list of others. His 30-plus years of entertainment industry experience has brought him to nearly every major venue and festival in the U.S. His career has taken him from promoting punk bands in the early 80s to managing large-scale tours. In this episode, we discuss the importance of mentor-mentee relationships, how to stay connected to the real world while on the road, being a working parent, nurturing a culture of respect, how it feels to be so close to returning to the road, as well as crisis management while on the road, and the toll it could take on our mental health. You can find him on Instagram at Jim Runge. Here is my conversation with Jim Runge. Hi, Jim. Welcome to the Tour Life Podcast. I'm so excited to chat. So how have you been? We're finally getting summer rolling. So how's it going?
Yes, thank God the weather's starting to become nice. I feel like my sanity can come back.
That's a real thing. I mean, especially us in the Midwest, it's like winter. Ugh.
Yeah, no, and luckily it was a somewhat nice winter. It wasn't too bad, but it was like just every day. It's like April's here. It's spring is coming. Spring is coming. It's getting warmer. I can sit outside. I don't have to be stuck in the house. Yeah, it was definitely this year too. It was a thing. Usually, you know, we're preparing on the road and we're getting ready to tour, so we're busy in our minds elsewhere. But this year, it was like weather is a focus. Now I get it.
Yeah, it's definitely different to, you know, be all over the place, be in different time zones and kind of get a little bit of everything and you still get your sunshine. But yeah, when you're stuck here and you don't have a choice, it can get rough. So let's talk a little bit about your background. You have toured with some awesome bands, and I'm just wondering, how did you even get started? Did you always know you wanted to be in the industry, or is it something that you fell into?
Something I fell into. I mean, I was always been into music, and music has been my life since I was a kid. I discovered punk at a young age in the 70s when I was preteen, and music kind of saved me. It gave me a reason I was in bands. The reason I got started in the first place was my bands needed someplace to play. So we booked our own shows. We found bowling alleys and venues to go to put our bands on. And as I got older, I became a stage manager with the people that I passed the promoting on to, and it just kind of grew. And then I eventually moved into I had a friend who worked at a really small lighting company in Green Bay where I grew up, and I went to work for him for a summer and then moved to Minneapolis. And I was in Minneapolis for a couple of years doing odd things, and another opportunity came up with a lighting company. And I decided that I was supposed to move to San Francisco, and I decided to stay in Minneapolis and continue working with this company. And I just kind of fell in love with the whole production thing, even though it was kind of not my background in music, you know, being punk productions isn't something we thought about. But it gave me a kind of an opportunity to work in an industry and see a different side of it and work with touring people. And I really just fell in love with it. And working in production, working for a lighting company. And that led me to, I was doing sales for them and sending out faxes. If those don't know what a fax is, it was email via phone line or something like that. It was something no one knows what they are anymore, but that shows how old I am and how long I've been doing this. But one fax in particular, I was doing it like till 2 a.m, just sending out 1,000 faxes to all these management companies. And finally I found this management company that had these little tiny At that point, Americana and alt country was kind of popular in the early mid 90s. And I had been a fan of some of the bands on this management's roster, which I knew couldn't afford production or didn't, you know, would probably be in, for the most part, like a bus tour, bus and trailer or a van. But I just decided to send this little note saying, I know you probably don't have a budget for it, but if you ever need any lighting, I'm a fan of your bands on your roster, and I'd love to help you guys out. And I went home next day at 9 a.m. The phone rings and this guy goes, I'm responding to your fax. And I was so tired that I was like, what fax? I don't know. I sent 1,000 out. I don't remember. What are you talking about? So I had to make him read the fax to me of the note that I wrote him. And he talked about he had this little country act in Austin that was going out, and this guy had come from the Promoters West era, where he had been tour managing the Cars and John Denver. So he was a fan of production, even though his bands weren't necessarily production bands. And he wanted me to do just a small package for floor lights and pricing it. And I said, sure, but you have to take me on the road with you as the LD. And it started from there. I started working with a tour manager, Eric Frankhauser, who's now the tour manager for Wilco. And we had teamed up for years doing different tours. And he retired for a short time to run a theater in Austin and gave me his bands that he had been working on. And I became a tour manager. It just kind of was accidental, and it did lighting for a little while, but eventually just fell in love with the part of it that is working with the artist and working to as part of a team, not just like the touring team, but a part of the artist team, and really, you know, working to do a project. I really fell in love with that aspect of it.
It's interesting that you were basically a part of an unwritten partnership.
Yeah.
At one point. That's so cool. So how did you find that sort of relationship, and how did it affect the way that your career developed, having somebody you could count on?
Well, I mean, I think we, you know, mentoring is an important thing in my career now. And I've always been a believer in mentor. And I think that's what is just having somebody to help me and be able and to this day, you know, I help Eric. It's kind of switched. Like, he now calls me because I've done some bigger tours and he's kind of done a certain level of tour, and he's called me for advice on stuff, and we help each other out. And I've just always felt, you know, so honored to have been part of this industry, that I'm always been a big thing of giving back to people. And, you know, I have probably a dozen mentees that I've done, and probably 40 or 50 over the years that I've worked with. It's always been important to me to give back. So that's always been important to me. And both sides of that, I have people that still mentor me, Stuart Ross, Marty Hom, guys that I respect and still help me out to this day, you know?
Yeah, that's something that I've seen just from speaking with people, being connected with other people. It's like the depth of the relationships that are built, you know, when people say tour family, you guys really mean it.
Yeah. Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah. My tour family is very important to me, and I'm, you know, it's closer to my tour family. In fact, I got married this year, and my tour family was right there along with my family. Like my Wendy Wilson, who's worked with me on a bunch of tours, and Anthony Pitcher, who's been my production manager for many years on many tours, you know, Rich Pluger, who now works, is a promoter up in Minneapolis, who I gave a start working at my record store in Green Bay. When he was a kid, stood up, all flew in to stand up for the wedding, despite, you know, the COVID, we safety distanced and all that, but they were, it was important enough that they all came in and for my wedding this year, you know, I'm very close to that, to my tour families. It means a lot to me.
Your wedding was so cool. I saw a couple shots on social media through Mark Clark.
Yeah. Mark came too. Mark was there also. Yeah. He flew in for it. Yeah.
So were you guys friends prior to TM 101?
Mark was kind of a mentee of mine, actually. He had contacted me at Coachella years ago. I was in town with Major Lazer at Coachella, and I had decided there's the week between weekends, the shows, and I decided to stay at the hotel for that weekend between to get some work done. And it just happened to be that Mark had stayed there too. And he called me up and said, do you want to meet? So we had never met before. We met there. And then he moved to Nashville shortly after that, where I'd been living. And we became friendly there. And something I do to give back is I was through these get-togethers about once a month. We'd get maybe 20 to 100 people there to show up every, you know, whenever we put them on, just from anywhere from hotel people to bus people to, because Nashville's obviously there's a lot of industry that goes on there. So we just brought in anybody that was connected to the entertainment industry, and Mark would come to those. So he and I got to know each other better through that also.
That's so neat. I thought it was cool, because it's like I'm kind of seeing your connections like from a distance, and it's really nice to see that even in a time where, you know, everybody's stuck at home, you're actually still able to build these deep connections. So tell me, how has it gone over the past year? What changes have you noticed in your relationships?
I mean, I think those relationships have become even more important. I mean, because now we're isolated, and especially so much of what we do is revolves around what we work, even our personal lives. I mean, a lot of people don't have personal lives because they're so engrossed in their work world, and they're gone so often that sometimes it's hard to, you know, have those relationships outside of work. So I've seen a lot of isolation and a lot of people like not knowing what to do with their time, not knowing who to talk to. They're used to just waking up on the bus and, you know, being and talking to somebody, having somebody there, you know, going into the venue and having people there. Now all of a sudden they're home and they can't leave their homes. So I was an advocate early on of just reaching out to people and reminding people to reach out to people, because it can be really, I mean, I was lucky that I, you know, I live with my wife and we're close, and, you know, we have a life outside of my touring work, and she's been a real advocate for mental health in the industry, and has kind of seen me and my friends, what we've gone through being on the road. So she owns a research company, and she's done actually some stuff for live production summit on mental health and that too. So she's aware of what this life is. So I've been lucky enough to be with somebody that understands what I'm going through, and, you know, that withdrawal, that not seeing my friends, not that, you know, that's, so we've really made a point to reach out to people and more so. In fact, I mean, especially with TM101, that I think I've developed deep relationships with people even more so than I had before, that I didn't necessarily ever tour with, but we've developed relationships because now we don't have the tour, but we have each other. So we've just worked on making that important, you know.
That is so cool that you're, obviously the relationships, the fact that you guys are finding a way to give back, and that, you know, that giving back and that leading with empathy really does bring you closer to everybody that you're doing it with. Mm-hmm. And also that your wife is obviously buying into everything and very much has seen what you go through and is willing and taking the interest to really do what she can to help. I think that's really great. Can you tell me a little bit more about the way that you two have gotten to that place where you have decided to in a very real way address the mental health situation?
Well, I mean, it's something that's ongoing. I mean, she's done some surveys with them and do it, but I think she's actually been on panels at LPS a couple of years ago when she's been to LPS twice with me. And this year it wasn't live, but, or it was via the internet. She, you know, she watched it with me, but she's been, I think it's something that we're ongoing. We want to get involved with. We want to work with Paul, because I mean, obviously he's not far away from us in Michigan. So that's something that we're interested in, is getting down there and being more involved with that. I think it's just something we're running, but it's more of a recognition that there is, mental health is a huge thing. It's isolation. It's, you know, besides just the obvious, like chemical abuse and alcohol abuse and those kinds of things that kind of come with the territory, but there's also a real isolation relationship. And I think part of it, this has shown up, is like, like you talked about earlier, is the isolation you feel with, you're used to being around people all the time, and those are your relationships, and you don't have to think about your friendship, your relationships, because they come to you on the road. You're in that city. You reach out to people that are there, and all of a sudden you're stuck at home. And where do you go? Who do you talk to? You actually have to reach out to people, and you have to actually consciously think about that. And that's something I don't think a lot of us do. I think we take it for granted, that life. And then when that life is shut down, we put so much into that, that we don't have those, you know, those personal lives. And then also too, being at home, like something that I noticed early on is that while we're on the road, you know, 6 weeks, you know, 6 months, life goes on. And I think, you know, it's really hard. I mean, I noticed years ago that I'd lived in Minneapolis a good part of my life, and I went, as I wasn't touring early on with my friendships, but I'd become really close with a group of people. And then we became adults, and a lot of them got married and had kids, and I was touring, and I'd be gone for 6 weeks, and I'd come back. And to me, my life there stopped when I went out on the road. And then it just kind of felt like it just started right where I left off when I came home. But then I'd go meet my friends, and they're, you know, they had kids, and their kids were walking, and they had bought houses, and they had, you know, all these, they had real lives, and they had things happen to them. And my life was like this series of like working, coming home. And then it's easy to not feel that gap when you're just working all the time. But then when all of a sudden, when you're off and you're in relationship with other people, like now you got to like, how do I make that work? Their lives are different than mine. Their lives are going on. My life is kind of like just stopping and starting in these integral pieces. And where now we're in a position where none of us are working, and we got to keep those relationships with our friends and, or even our loved ones. Now we're at home with our wives and our girlfriends, boyfriends, husbands, and we got to try to figure being around 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, when we're used to these breaks. And a lot of people get in relationships because they have those breaks, and now all of a sudden there are no breaks. Now you really have to deal with this. And now all those things that you've been kind of not dealing with for years, because you're on the road and you can have the breaks, and you can forget about it for 6 weeks to a couple months. And then you can just tolerate them, you know, while they're home, because you know they're leaving again. Now you don't have those breaks anymore. Now you don't have that. You can't, that escape isn't there. Now you have to deal with real life. You have to deal with real issues. And I think that's been a lot of people have been dealing with, is all of a sudden like life, we can kind of put life on hold for a few. And I guess that's what I'm kind of getting out. In touring in general, we can put life on hold for 6 weeks, a year, or whatever we're on the road. And we can just focus on working and not deal with real life or the real world. Where in the last year plus, we haven't been able to do that. Now all of a sudden the real world is kicking us every day, and we have to deal with it. Now it's real, you know? And and we're not used to that. A lot of people are having issues with that.
Yeah. Take me back to the time, because you said they have real lives, is what you said.
Yeah.
So take me back to the time when you realized that, and what does that mean to you?
I think it means that there's a fan. I think in touring, there's like this, it's, and it's, the fantasy world isn't necessarily the word I'm looking for, but we live in this like, or it's a bubble. We live in a bubble where everything is taken care of us. Our hotel is taken care of. Our food is taken care of. Our life, our checks are sent to us, and they arrive in the bank. We don't think about like our life is. We definitely have our own lives, and we're definitely like structured, but it's so structured that we do it, and we don't have the stuff going on at home because we're not at home. And then we deal with our friends, and we realize that, oh, this is what I'm missing. And some of it you don't want to deal with, but there's other parts of it like, well, this is what I'm giving up for this lifestyle. And I don't want to necessarily do anything else. But then you realize that you do, and you are giving something up for doing this, because I think it's happened with anybody that travels, you're a salesman or whatever it is. I think that you have two separate lives, and it's really kind of trying to combine those and keep those two lives going is really hard work. You know, you really have to be conscious of it, that there are two separate lives that we're leaving, and trying to keep it as one life as much as possible, you know?
Do you think there's a time in everyone's careers where they come to the realization that, you know, that there's something that they're giving up, and then, and do you think there's some sort of conflict that happens in everyone's life? And if you do, or if you experience anything like that, what do you think about it?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely, it leads to a conflict, I think, in a lot of people's lives, because I think that you get used to a certain way of living. And then when you go home, like you don't know, no one, there's no catering, you know, you have to like, think about, you know, you have to get your coffee in the morning. You have to do all that stuff that I think when you're on the road, you just take so much of it for granted. And that, like I said before, you're in such a bubble that you don't think about life outside of that bubble, you know, which is why I also advocate like reaching out. One of the things I advocate to people is like reaching out. I mean, definitely if you're in a relationship, you know, talking to your partner, a significant other, you know, making sure you take that time every day to do that. But even with friends, keeping those relationships going, because like I said, it is really easy. I noticed it with even some of my really good friends that become alienated because they don't relate to me anymore. And I don't relate to them anymore because our lives are so, they've become parents and they've become, and granted, there's a lot of us that are parents. I have kids that are on the road, but it's a different relationship than somebody who's with their kids 24/7 or, you know, on a normal life than it is to us who see our kids on breaks from tour. So I think that it's just something you got to be aware of all the time, that life goes on, and you keep in touch with those, with family, with friends, and always investing in those relationships too, because you need them in the long run, which is what I think has happened in the last year, that we do need those relationships outside of touring, you know, that's important to have that life.
Yeah, because then you feel like you have something to come home to, right? Yeah. Does that help?
For sure.
Yeah. So tell me about your kids. How old are they?
My oldest son is actually 35. He's actually a drum tech and stage manager. So he's been touring for 20 years. So he's a road warrior at this point, an A-list drum tech. And he's worked a lot of the same tours I have, but a lot of other tour separate from me too over the years. And then I have another son who is 11, will be 12 this year. And then I have two stepkids, one 12 and one 20. Wow. Two girls. So I have two boys, and then my wife has two girls.
That's so cool. So I'm interested. Have you had any conversations with your son who tours about like why he chose to do it after watching you do it?
I mean, honestly, I think from early age, it's just been something that he wanted to do. I remember still being at the rave in Milwaukee, and I was doing lights for Paula Cole at the time, and him coming down. And at that time, he was like, he was, you know, probably 10 or 11, and said right then, like, I want to do lighting, which he didn't do, but he's, you know, let it be known that he wanted to tour. And I'd let it go as a kid thing. I never thought much about it. And then he graduated from high school, and he'd always said that if there's anything that I can ever do, I want to do it. And I, you know, didn't think much of it. And he was only a couple days out of high school, and a friend of mine called saying that he needed a driver for a Warp Tour, an merch seller for Warp Tour. And I called up my son and said, this is your chance. If you want to tour, somebody needs a driver and merch seller. and you leave for Boise tomorrow night. And like literally 24 hours later, he was on the road and he loved it. And he's been doing it full time ever since. So, yeah. I think at an early age, he just decided he wanted to do it. And I think once he had the opportunity, he never stopped. He just kept going. Yeah.
Yeah. He rolled with it.
Yeah.
Did you have a talk with him like to sort of like prep him for the road?
Yeah. I mean, basically it was just like, don't screw it up. But I think we did. And then early on, I think after he did a couple of years on Warped Tour working with this punk band on there. So he kind of, I think I'd seen him develop the relationships and his work ethic that I really hadn't seen before, that I, you know, really noticed from just getting feedback from other people, that he just kind of took it on. And then I brought him out on a tour with me as a merch seller. And I just saw that he, you know, he was good at it. And then he became a drum tech, and he just kind of, I mean, we've definitely had a few talks over the years, but I think he'd been around me enough to know how the road works. And I think because of my relationship to him, he kind of was probably treated better on most of the tours that he was on because of my relationship with other people. So he had a lot of people taking him under their wing and, you know, showing him the ropes and kind of more so than I did. I think I was there to kind of like change directions if I saw things going bad, which I think they rarely did. But he had enough people kind of like that were his tour dads and stuff that kept an eye on him, that he never really faltered. He kind of knew what he wanted right from the beginning and did it. So, yeah.
That's so cool. So what was your reaction when you were like, oh, wow, he's actually going to do this?
I mean, pride, and also, you know, it felt like this one thing, especially being a dad who was, touring and, not with him a lot growing up, that I finally gave him something. You know, I feel like that he's like, I can forgive myself for maybe not being there when he was growing up as much, because I gave him a career. You know, I gave him something that no one else could really have given him the way that I did. So that I felt like, well, I can forgive myself for a lot of this other stuff, because I gave him this thing that hopefully will last him the rest of his life, and that he can, you know, he can take and make a career out of and have a life with, which he has. So, you know, he has a big house here in Green Bay, and he's married and has a stepson. And so I think he's succeeded at life in a lot of ways, probably better than I have. So he's I'm pretty proud of him. He's done pretty well.
That's awesome. And I think that, you know, that guilt that we feel, and I think any working parent will feel that guilt, whether they're home or not. I mean, a lot of, like, my parents, for example, they worked like all the time. Like, I, you know, so I'm just like, oh, I practically raised myself.
Yeah. No, I feel the same way. Yeah.
Right. And so parents have that guilt, and it's nice to, I guess, kind of see that it wasn't for nothing, and you gave them a unique opportunity, you know, to pursue something, and then you just supported them along the way. That's really cool. So how have the things that you've learned through your relationship with your eldest son, how has that influenced the way that you deal with your younger kids?
I think the big difference with him is that with my younger son, I had more money that he grew up on the road. He traveled with me to Europe. He got to spend a week in the bus touring Italy, Spain, and Portugal with me. We had our own bus with the band's manager and his two kids. And so he's seen most of the U.S., a lot of Europe. So he got to actually experience the life, and his brother was there too, which was cool. So he got to spend that time with his brother and watch his brother work while on the road. So I think mainly is that, as I was in a different spot to do that, and and taught him, although his mother says that he'll never work in the industry like his brother and myself, but we'll see.
Well, they are their own people. So yes. I guess they make that yeah. decision. Well, right?
If you knew his mother, that might not be the truth, but
she's like over my dead yeah. body.
He's probably not going to be allowed to have his own life. So
the funny thing is, though, that's when you know, we as individuals decide, like, oh, yeah. you know, to do the exact opposite our parents told us to do. So
totally.
That's funny. Well, that's really awesome. I think it's cool. You know, one of the things that I know when you're young to begin with is you want to like eventually you get to the point where you realize, like, well, maybe I do want to have a family and maybe I do want to do this, but sometimes there's a conflict with the lifestyle that's going to go with whatever career you choose. And so it's so nice to hear that even though it's not your typical, you know, what is it, the atomic family
yeah.
structure situation with, you know, the traditional 9 to 5 and you come home yeah. and have dinner with your kids every day. It's still, although it's completely different, it has so much value and it's just like anything. And it's okay to have a different type of lifestyle.
Yeah, for sure.
Have any new parents ever approached you about kind of like, what to watch out for?
I don't know if I'm the best role model in that world, so I don't know. I mean, we've talked a little bit of, like, Henry, you know, has a child now, and I've talked to a couple people like that who have, you know, younger kids, and you know, when I was with the Black Keys, they were just having kids or had kids, so I've, you know, discussed a little bit about that with them. But like, I think most of it has been is dealing with, they see me as dealing with my oldest son now where I wasn't there, but now I've developed that relationship because we've toured together and we've been together. So I think that they, I would be the last person to give advice on parenting as a child, but I, you know, would probably be more so of like, you know, trying to help them out as adults and trying to like lead them on the right path and give them good advice and being the cool dad more so as an adult than I would be as a, you know, growing up. Cause God knows I made a lot of mistakes and I would be horrified to give somebody advice because that probably wouldn't be the right advice for children.
And you know, the oldest kid always has to deal with the yeah. amateur parent, right?
And he did. He really did. Yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah. I didn't really give my parents a whole lot of credit until I became a mom. Yeah. And I was like, oh, turns out none of us have any idea what we're doing.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
That's so cool. So tell me, it seems like you place a lot of importance on developing your relationships, about caring for people on a different level than, you know, just a surface level. So tell me, how do you handle your tours and what do you prioritize when you're planning a tour so that, you know, it's a good experience?
Touring is a weird animal because it's probably one of the only careers in music or in what we do that you live with and are around 24 hours a day, the people who, especially in as a tour manager place, like you have this weird relationship with the artist who is your boss, but you're also their boss. So it's this weird push and pull all the time is because they pay you. They're the reason you're there. Their name's on the marquee, but you're telling them where they have to be every day, what they have to do every day, how they have to do it every day. So it's this, you know, the weird thing of like pushback of trying to like keep that relationship. And then you have all these people who you, a lot of times you've hired or you have the power to hire and fire and you're living with them. So you know, whether it be 5, 10, 100 people, you're kind of in, you're with them, especially when if you're, you know, you're on a bus, like in a smaller tour of like 12 people or something, and you're on the bus with them and you're with them backstage and you're with them setting up the show and you're around them 24 hours a day, you have to get along with them and you have to figure out how you do that, but also keep that respect so that they understand you're the boss. So I feel like that's, I don't have a lot of strong points as a tour manager, but I think the one thing I do is I'm a good manager in that way of, it doesn't always work out, but I always pride myself in, for most of the tours, I've developed lifelong friendships, but also lifelong respects, because it's one thing to be like the clown and be that guy and they think they're going to always get something over on you, but it's a whole different thing when they love you and respect you. You're their friend, but you're also, because I was told early on by Eric Frankhauser, you know, don't become friends with the people you tour with, because one, you may have to fire them. Two, you may have to, they may have to fire you. And so you have to keep that kind of in the back of your head that, you know, no matter how, you know, how good of a relationship you think you have with somebody, because of nature, because we're working, we're not, these aren't friendships in the sense like that anything goes. These are working relationships and working friendships that you have to be aware that and not let it destroy you. Cause we've all been to those situations where we're let go from a tour or we're not asked back from a tour or something happens, and whether it's our fault or not, we have to let somebody go who we're friends with, or we have to be let go for whatever reason. And it's really hard not to take that personal. And that's really difficult to deal with. So it's really a strange position to as a career choice to put yourself into, where you always got to kind of be kind of aware in the back of your mind of what your relationship is, and that, you know, it's like if you're with your friends at home every day, you just, you know, you go home and you develop these relationships, and if they annoy you, you just go home. But there's no escaping that on the road. Like you live that life 24 hours a day. And even if you lock yourself in your hotel room, who's doing what at the bar, who's doing what in town, who's said what to who, you still have to deal with those personalities of people and keeping that, like, that peace and those positive relationships and the respect. And it's really, it can be a difficult, you know, position to put yourself into.
Yeah. It sounds like developing respect is huge. And where a lot of people go wrong is that they try to demand respect without establishing something. So what would that something be that allows the respect to flow?
I mean, for me, I try to add humor to it and sarcasm. I like try to like have fun and, you know, make the job fun, but also know that I'm there. I can also be like, you know, it's okay if they need to cry on my shoulder, I'm going to be there for them. I'm also sensitive enough to know that, you know, we also like tend to be this, you know, whether we like it or not, the psychologist, you know, we tend to be that therapist there to listen to people's problems, because we all, I mean, when we go through stuff, especially stuff at home, it's even harder than most people, because we can't just run to our phones and be on our phones all day dealing with it, or run home because something's gone wrong at home. I mean, it's, we're at work. This is what we do. This is what we signed up for. And so it can be a difficult position to be in. And you just got to be that person to be able to talk that person through it and do the, or figure out a way to, whether it be having somebody fly, being able to cover the job for somebody or do something if it's an emergency. You just got to be open and willing to like try everything and just be there for that person as much as possible.
Yeah, I think that being there is, I guess, the key word, right? And what you were describing really was, what was showing up for me was, you know, like your favorite teacher in school. It's like you respect them, they're an authority figure, but you know that you can count on them. You know that if you need to talk to them after class, they're going to allow you to talk, and they're going to give you, you know, whatever they can, but at the end of the day, they really are just someone that you trust.
Yeah, exactly.
So tell me, we are about to be jumping into kind of a weird summer, because we don't really know what's happening. And by the time this airs, this will be early summer. So what is going on? I mean, I feel like there's lots of conversations happening. There's a lot of, I don't know, but I'm not necessarily asking about like what's going to happen, because, you know, we really don't know. But how is this uncertainty and this kind of, I guess, a little bit of excitement and like not really knowing what's going on, how is that affecting you personally?
A lot of mixed emotions, like one, excitement to do it. I mean, part of it is like, I feel like I'm a better tour manager coming out of this than I was, because especially with having done, you know, 70 episodes of TM 101, I've become, I've learned so much from my colleagues and what we're doing that I didn't know. I mean, I didn't realize how little I knew, how bad of a tour manager I was until we started doing TM 101. And I'm like, oh, that's how you're supposed to do that. Oh, okay. Now I get it. Now I can, you know, so I'm looking forward to bringing those new skills that I've learned and, you know, been able to work on that I've never been able to really work on, because you're always working. You never have time to like hone up on your Excel skills and that kind of stuff. So there's an excitement for that. There's also an apprehension of like, can I still do it? I mean, I've been off for a year, and you know, am I aging myself out? Am I, you know, is it time to hang it up? And you know, there's those, and then there's also the unknowns of like, God, we're living with COVID, and how are we going to do? Are we dealing with normal shows, or are we dealing with these weird cut down shows? And is it going to just be festivals to start out with? Or are we going to be doing real? There's just so many questions that are going through a mind, and I think everyone else's mind, of like, until it really happens, we're going to be like faking it, you know. Because nobody has a clue what's going to happen. I mean, it definitely looks like things are moving in the right direction, but then once we get there, it's going to be getting to the edge of that cliff and going like, all right, we got here. Now are we going to try to jump over it, or are we just going to walk over it and hope we land and don't kill ourselves? You know, it's nobody knows. We don't know. It's terrifying.
It is. Yeah. It's scary. I think that visual that you gave about standing at the cliff, and it's funny because, you know, with all the years of experience, it's like there's muscle memory there, right? There's like, you know how to do it, but there's a little bit of fear. I'm interested, like, how do you deal with fear when it happens?
The biggest thing is not let it show. I mean, I think that's one of the things I've heard of people say to me is like, oh, you look so calm, or look like you had it. It's like, I was terrified inside. I'm like freaking out, but like, you just can't show. I kind of put like sometimes like, which is probably not the best term to use, but it's like, I use the analogy of working with artists and working with people sometimes can be like training dogs. It's like, you can't show fear. Like, you just got to like always put on that, like, that face of like, oh, don't worry about it, we'll get through it, it's, let me take care of it. And you walk in the corner and you pound yourself against the wall and panic for 5 minutes, and then you get on your phone and you figure it out and you make it work. And we usually have our networks, we have our magic, you know, our magic packets that we can throw out and make, you know, make anything happen. But I think it's working through it, because we can't, if we panic and we freak out, we're useless. We're going to lose our jobs. I mean, so there's nothing to be gained by panicking. It's like, we just have to work through it and fix whatever the problem is, whether it means the right fix, or whether it means like just putting a Band-Aid on it until we can, you know, get it right, or get on to the next point. But at some point we got to make a decision. And that's especially as tour managers, that's what we do. It's like making those decisions, whether they're the right ones or the wrong ones, we have to make them. And then we got to deal with the outcome of that, and whether we got to fix that thing too. It's just what we do.
I love that. I love it. You know, that it sounds like a pretty straightforward formula, right? It's, you don't show the fear immediately. Yeah. You take it in. then you give yourself a minute to freak out and feel the fear. And then you let it go and then you get back.
Yeah. With, and the important part about that is making sure no one else sees it, like going into the next room or calling somebody that you can scream at and vent for a minute and then be like, okay, I got that off my chest. Now I'm going to make this happen. Yeah.
Oh, and that actually is such a good idea. It's maybe setting up, and you tell me what you think, but maybe setting up someone who's your friend who you know you can call. You feel like you may get a call from me freaking out. I just want you to be aware that I just need this. Please help.
Yeah. Yeah. And I actually, that's probably a better idea than what my idea, because my idea would probably be calling my wife, which is probably not the best experience because you don't want to be freaking out on them. So it's probably better if you have a friend or even somebody in the office. Like I work with Wendy Wilson a lot and she's been my sounding board for years. Like I just like take her and it's, you know, tell her what's going on and together we help figure out. So if you're lucky enough to tour with somebody that's your sounding board, that's another great reason to have that tour family that you can trust and work out, because it's always great to have a team. And Adrian is part of that too. Adrian and I have toured together for years too. And just having those people that you can go to that are with you right there and know what the issues are and what the issues to the issues to the issues are, that you don't even have to explain. They already jumped ahead to where you are, you know. It's always so helpful.
Yeah, it's really important to know each other's personalities too and kind of see how you deal with situations so that when you are in crisis management mode, people know what to expect and then nobody takes it personally.
Yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm. So tell me a story about a crisis that you managed.
Well, I'll tell you a sad one. One of the worst ones, and this is I'd been working with Jerry Cantrell from Alice in Chains on a solo record for 2 days. I'd met him at the airport at LAX and we worked for, I think, 2 days of doing press. And I was having a meeting with somebody from the label and Bill Siddons, who was his manager at the time, who was the manager for the Doors and Crosby, Stills and Nash, was manager of the Doors when Jim Morrison died. So he's dealt with some pretty hardcore stuff in his time too. And he's a really good friend of mine. And we're having this meeting and his phone started ringing. The business manager kept calling him and he kept hanging up because we were in a meeting and he kept hanging up. And finally, after like six times, he finally yells, "Lori, I'm in a meeting. I can't talk now." And all of a sudden his face turned white and he stood up and walked away. And we were in the, like I said, the really the first and second day of doing press for a brand new record that was coming out the week after. And Bill comes up to me and said, "Meeting's over. Jim, can I talk to you?" And we kind of walked, we were outside the pool at the hotel and we walked a few feet away and he kind of leans against the table and goes, "Well, we have a problem." He goes, Lane Staley, the singer of Alice in Chains, he goes, "They just found him dead in his apartment." And he goes, "What should we do?" And I'm like, "You're the guy that buried Jim Morrison and dealt with his death in Paris. Like, you're coming to me and asking me what we should do. Like, I don't know. I'm just the tour manager. I don't, how am I to deal with this? I've known this guy 2 days." And finally, I sat there, we stood there a while, and I said, "Well, look, we know we're not getting any more press done after this. This is the last day, and I think there were some interviews waiting in the lobby." And we were in a position that said, "You know, we're not developing any press after this. Like, this is where this is going to be it. You know, this is going to be so devastating that if the tour doesn't end, we're certainly not going to get interviews, because he's not going to want to discuss this after every interview that we do for the next year. So let's get these big interviews done with now." And I said, "I'm going to go in with him in the sit-in in the interviews, steal his phone so that, because we know his phone's going to be ringing off the hook. So I'm going to steal his phone and shut it off, make sure nobody talks to him. We're going to finish these 3 or 4 interviews. And then we're going to tell him." And we did that. We got through the whole thing. And as we get done with it, Jerry's like, I'm tired. He goes, can you tell Bill that I just want to rest? I don't want to see him right now. And I said, we need you for a minute. There's something we need to discuss with you. And then we brought it in, we had told him, and it was like, you know, things blew up. And then we had to, I used orbits for the first time in my life. That's where I learned how to use orbits, because I had to fly every bit of family into, at the time, Chris Cornell and Susan Silver were married still in Seattle. And we had to fly everybody to their place to make plans. This was before, a couple of days before we announced it. And I just learned for the first time, just like, how to on your feet dealing with people. I didn't know these people, like, you know, the band, I'd never met them yet. I was the new guy. I was 2 days on the job, but I just learned that I had to step up and do what needed to be done and take care of things. And, you know, the next day was, you know, I had to do rehearsals with Jerry not being there. We started band rehearsals without him, because we still had to go on. We still had tours to do. And we still had to, you know, we still toured for 2 years after that, but it was rough, but we, you know, we made it through it. But it was just you know, I learned early on that nothing stops it. Like, if you, you know, if you decide you're going to move on and go on, that you just got to move on, no matter what kind of pain is going on personally or whatever thing we do is if we can make it keep going, we just keep going. And then it's not an easy life, but it's, you know, we got to do what we got to do to finish what we're doing, you know? So.
How was it when you came home from that tour for you?
I don't know that one in particular, because we, you know, we ended up getting Jerry sober after that. I mean, to be honest, because Jerry's very open about this, because he got sober 2 years later. I mean, I ended that tour thinking that I would never see him again, thinking that he would not live beyond that. He was on his way to the same end. And I mean, I couldn't listen to Alice in Chains without getting PTSD for years from hearing those songs and doing that. And, you know, so I think it really, like, I learned from it, but it was also a hard lesson, you know, to learn. I mean, I'm happy these days when I see Jerry and, you know, we're still friendly, and to see him and see him healthy and see him, you know, living life, and all those guys, I think they're all sober now and doing really well. And, you know, it was a hard thing to deal with at the time, but I think it made me stronger and better to have dealt with it and been there and survived it. You know, to be honest, I don't remember. I think it took me years to get over that. I think that's one of the things with, you take a tour and you take another tour and you take another tour, that, you know, it was probably years before I finally dealt with it, because I was just working my way through it, just not really going back to thinking about it, just going forward with the tour, and you work to kind of cover up the pain of, and the PTSD of dealing with this, you know, situations like that, you know?
Yeah. And yeah, you push it off until you can't any longer.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So now we've had a while, we've had over a year where I feel like a lot of people are in that place where they had been pushing things off. It just kept themselves busy. And then they were forced to come to a stop. Is that something that you went through in any aspect of your life? And did you learn anything from it? And how are you going to take those lessons with you into the future?
I don't know if I've come through it. I mean, I think this year has been that, because I had a stroke this year. I mean, I got married this year. The COVID happened this year. So I think this is the year, I think, that was the most reflective. Like, and I had the time to think about it. Like, it was kind of like, I mean, I was 9 days, I had stroke and COVID at the same time. I was locked for 2 weeks. I was in a room where the only person, people that could come see me had to work, get into hazmat suits, and even to ask somebody to come scratch your back or, you know, let you out of bed. I couldn't even get out of bed because it's stroke. Like, yeah. So it was, you know, for 2 weeks being isolated without really, you know, being able to see anyone. I mean, I obviously had my phone, I could FaceTime or talk, but like, and not even be able to get out of bed. So it had a lot of time to think. And I think that was, luckily TM101 had already been happening at that point. So I was already doing that, but I think it really, and I got married 3 weeks before that. So it really kind of put things in perspective of what was important. And also too, I think, I mean, it showed how important my career is, but it showed there is no career without that personal, those personal relationships, whether it be my touring family or my family. It's that balance is so important. And I think a lot of people have learned that over this thing, is that it's really finding that balance of, it's not just work, it's not just home, but you got to find that balance of making the two work together. It's really important.
Yeah. And you have to make the time, right?
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Absolutely.
Yeah. It's easy to get too busy and keep yourself busy and forget. Well, that's amazing. Your story is amazing. And thank you so much for sharing it.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
All right. Well, have an amazing night and we'll talk soon.
Thanks. You too.
Here are some key takeaways from my conversation with Jim Runge. 1. Mentor-mentee relationships are incredibly important in the music industry. It's a symbiotic relationship that can help get you farther than you could alone. 2. 2020 and 2021 have been rough, but it has really taught us how important it is to consciously reach out and check on your friends, family, and colleagues. 3. In touring, it's easy to put life on hold while you're on the road. But remember that the real world still needs to be dealt with. Take time to think about how you can stay connected to both worlds without completely giving up on one of them. 4. Lifelong respect. That's the goal. No matter how good of a relationship you think you have with someone, professional relationships are not typical friendships. So be sure to stay aware of what your relationship is and prioritize nurturing a culture of mutual respect and peace within your space and team. And 5, crisis management is a skill that is learned on the job. The effects that each crisis takes on us may not be obvious. So make sure to take the time to reflect afterward and consciously work through that trauma. And don't hesitate to ask for help if you need it. Thank you so much for joining us on the Tour Life Podcast. Be sure to give Jim a follow on Instagram at Jim Runge. And don't forget to like, subscribe, leave a review on iTunes, and to follow the Tour Life on Instagram at the Tour Life Podcast.